something.
Horrible things.
What works before was changing Dan's slide before, so let's see if that's, which is an impressive power. Yeah, okay. Okay. So, first of all, I'd really like to thank Andre for inviting me. This intermediate program you guys have is just terrific. So, and I'd like to thank Dan for giving such a spectacular introduction to this whole area. I agree with him 100% that this is just an enormous problem, and I think it's really this, like he pointed out, the scale. Dan, you're changing my talk.
I know. I just realized that, so I made sure I
need help. Let's try that. Okay, yeah.
Are you done swimming around now, Dan?
Yeah.
Once you use your laser pointer, you can point to other things on the slide. But yeah, I mean, the scale of the problem, it's just staggering. What I'm going to talk about is some of the stuff that I'm going to frame the problem in terms of PVs. That's what we work on in my group, and we're using femtosecond spectroscopy to try and understand various aspects of them that I think are significant if we want to talk about increasing the efficiency. But before I do that, I want to just give a couple of things that that Dan didn't mention, mostly in the way of pictures. This is one of my favorite photographs. I pulled this off the NASA website. So this is a composite photograph. I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, the Earth at night. So I give a toned-down version of this talk at undergraduate schools. And some poor freshman who came to see the talk, and I didn't have the heart to really dig into him a little bit, because he asked the question, how did they take a picture of the Earth where it was night all at the same time? So I didn't have the heart to tell him that the Earth's not flat either, but I learned that in geography. So this is kind of a fascinating picture. I mean, you can see the energy density. I mean, the Earth, or the United States rather, 25% of energy consumption. But we've got far less than that, of course, in the population. The one that always fascinates me, there's some party going on way the hell out in the middle of nowhere. There's like, you look at a map, there's like two rocks in the middle, and they seem to be having a great time. So that's pretty cool. So here's a close-up of the United States. Boston, obviously, right here. East Lansing is somewhere right around there. So you can find your favorite city. Now, I'm sure you guys all remember back in 2003, the blackout on the East Coast. This floated around the internet for a while. Kind of looks like the ocean washed in and wiped everything out. Turns out this is a hoax, so those of you who sort of enjoyed looking at that picture, there are a couple of reasons that you can tell. Number one, there's apparently no satellite called GeoStar. Usually satellites don't really link themselves to Eastern Standard Time. And then the other problem is that it's probably not the case that in one night the entire United States is totally cloud-free. So I dug around and actually found pictures which are relevant from that blackout. So this was taken the night before the blackout, so you can see the lights along the East Coast, and this was taken at the same time during the blackout. So you can really see an enormous effect, and this just sort of underscores the fact that these types of power outages and other disasters are really on the horizon if we don't really take this problem seriously. Of course, I'm preaching to the choir here, but it's really kind of a scary problem. Dan mentioned these pictures. I don't know if some of you guys have seen these pictures or not, but these are kind of striking. There was a gentleman who goes around the world, and he found old photographs of like glaciers and other things, and he spent a lot of time and effort getting photographs from the exact same angle at the exact same time of day. So this is a glacier in Austria, 1875, and this is what it looks like as of 2004. That's a dam. These are buildings down here, so that's a hell of a lot of ice that has just vanished, right? This is then, so there's the comparison over a period of just over, 125 years. You go down to South America, and this is what the glacier looked like in 1928. These, again, are fairly large structures down here. That's all gone. Kind of staggering. This is on the coast of North Carolina. Just because of the storms and the erosion that's occurring, just in the span of 5 years, you can see that you went from, you know, would look like something typically you'd see on a beach to completely eroded away and basically disappeared. And this is a result of the increase in storm intensities, among other things that are happening as we speak. So what we work on in my group concerns the photovoltaic part of the problem that Dan alluded to. And as you all know, photovoltaics right now are made largely from silicon, polycrystalline or amorphous silicon, have different efficiencies. a paper came out in Nature in 1991, which really revolutionized at least how to think about what types of materials you may use for photovoltaics. The nice thing about silicon-based technology, of course, is that it's pretty efficient. I think the theoretical limit is upwards about 30%, depending on how you fabricate the cell and the material and everything. But the problem is cost. On an energy-intensive basis, you're looking at about a factor of 10 difference between silicon per kilowatt hour versus oil. And as Dan alluded to, you know, that's just providing a socioeconomic barrier that's simply not going to be penetrated, let alone the politics of it. What Gretzel did is he created a new type of solar cell based on TiO2. TiO2 is pretty cheap, right? I mean, basically anything you see that's white usually has TiO2 in it for a coloring agent, right? So it's in everything from paint chips to powdered donuts, which is kind of depressing. First time I realized I was cramming for a PChem exam, and I looked on the, 2 o'clock in the morning, you're studying thermo, you need some food, and the second last ingredient was titanium dioxide. I'm like, Jesus. So anyway, but the point is it's really cheap, right? But it's terrible for a material by itself because obviously it's white. The band gap's about 3.3 electron volts, and that's going to push you into the ultraviolet, and that's not where most of the solar flux is. So as a solar material by itself, TiO2 is a bad choice. Gretzel did two things. One, he went to nanoparticle TiO2, okay? So that automatically improves your situation because you've got an enormous increase in surface area as opposed to, say, single crystal TiO2. But that doesn't do anything about the spectroscopic aspects of it. What he did is he took a molecule, and here's the example of the molecule, these thiocyanates right here are in black for some stupid reason. This ruthenium chromophore, he covalently attached that to the surface of TiO2. And as I'm going to show you in a little bit, what you can do is you can photoexcite this molecule, produce a charge transfer excited state where the electron is localized in a pi star orbital, which is conjugated directly into the TiO2. So what you essentially have is upon excitation, you directly inject the electron in the conduction band. So the production of electricity here is not electron hole conduction, but it's simply electron conduction through a circuit. But the nice thing about this is that the ground state of this ruthenium chromophore lies in the band gap of TiO2. So instead of having a 3.3 eV gap to overcome, you've got something that's closer to about 1.5 or 1.6 eV. So the absorption curve to produce photoelectricity gets shifted into the visible. Okay, that was a significantly, when you couple that with the fact that these 20 to 50 nanometer particles each have about 1,000 chromophores on them, you start talking about enormous absorption cross-sections with absorption cross-sections that are now in the visible instead of the ultraviolet. So those two things combined make for a pretty inexpensive device. Right now, the overall conversion efficiencies are sitting at around 11%. That's if you do everything just right. More typically, you're looking at things that are about 8 or 9%. And just to put this in perspective, if you use this technology, the economic break-even point versus silicon for this type of device is about 15%. So if you can make this thing up to about 15%, or better yet, make it about 20%, you'll completely displace silicon-based technology in photovoltaics across the board. All right, so that's kind of a tantalizing thing because I'm going to show you the operation of the cell and particularly the efficiency issues are directly linked to the nature of this chromophore. And this is where chemists and spectroscopists can play an enormous role because it's the optical and electron transfer properties of these types of materials that really define the efficiency, and it's what's going to cause these things to push beyond this sort of barrier that people are sort of asymptotically approaching right now. So just to give you a little more detail, these are regenerative solar cells, right? They turn over. The basic idea is initially you start off with photon absorption by the chromophore. The excited state lies above the conduction band. Then you get electron ejection, interfacial electron transfer. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. Then what happens is what I like to call a miracle occurs. It's actually astounding that these things work at all. So these things are basically a mesoporous layer of these nanoparticle TiO2. It's about 10 microns thick, and you coat it onto a conductive glass slide, usually fluorinated indium tin oxide. The chromophores are attached to these nanoparticles. The nanoparticles themselves are not linked to each other, right? So it's just basically a film that you sinter onto the glass slide. So these electrons basically have to, by percolation, just wind their way to the collecting electrode. It's absolutely amazing that you get the current efficiencies that you actually see. So this percolation process occurs, and you collect the electrons here, you pass it through a load, and then what you do is you have an in-situ redox agent, and the one that works most efficiently is a mixture of lithium iodide and I2. That creates a mixture of I- and I3- in solution, and that essentially what it does is it regenerates that, it refills that hole. So you have photoexcitation, oxidation of your sensitizer, and then this in-situ redox couple basically refills the hole so you can turn it over and over again. And the estimated lifetime, these things are actually fairly robust. So the ones that Gretzel are producing, they do sort of simulated solar conditions, and they're quoting, the first paper that came out, they didn't say about the simulated solar condition. The material had been, or the paper was only published 5 years earlier, and they said it had 15 years worth of stability. It's like, okay. But they simulated 15 years worth of sunlight. So these things can be fairly robust. There are a lot of aspects of this that have to sort of go just right in order for these things to work effectively. For example, you've got to be able to refill this hole before the electron finds its way back into the oxidized sensitizer, right? This thing's a pretty decent oxidant once that electron goes into the TiO2 nanoparticle. There's dark current issues. Your redox mediator can interact with the TiO2 particles. You can get short-circuiting that way. You've got to have efficient collection here. Your open circuit voltage, which is one of the key components defining the overall power efficiency, is dictated by sort of the quasi-Fermi level associated with the TiO2 and wherever this potential sits for the redox mediator. And that's actually what I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about today. So the kinetics of all these processes have to be just right for these things to really work optimally. And this is where spectroscopy plays a key role, because that's how you're going to understand the kinetics. And then with that understanding, you can then go on and try and develop more efficient materials, more efficient devices. So the metrics of solar cell performance that people use is actually pretty simple. Okay, it's basically a function of essentially two variables. Right? How many electrons can you get into the TiO2, and what potential does each of those electrons possess? Right, and that's in this field, that's basically defined by the short circuit current. Okay, so basically how many number of electrons you can push through the cell. It's usually described in terms of a current density. Short circuit currents for typical devices are on the order of 3.5 to 4 milliamps, so you're looking at roughly 20 milliamps per square centimeter for these types of cells. Right, so that's the maximum number of currents. That's going to basically correlate with the absorption cross-section. How efficiently can you collect photons, and then how efficiently can you convert those photons into conduction band electrons for the TiO2. The next thing is going to be the potential, which is called the open circuit voltage, and that's basically, like I said, the energy difference between the quasi-Fermi level of TiO2 and the redox mediator that you're using. Right? That's going to define the potential per electron. That's going to be coupled largely to the power spectrum, the power solar spectrum. It's basically how much energy are you extracting out of those photons. Right? And that's really the key problem, I think, right now with why these cells are not as efficient as they could be, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then the spill factor is basically how efficiently are you really doing. The optimal power would be the product of the short circuit current density and the open circuit voltage. You don't quite realize that. Spill factors are typically about 70%. So this X right here represents the optimal balance between between current and voltage, and you just divide that by that's divided by the amount of power in, and that gives you your efficiency. So right now these efficiencies, like I said, are in the order of 10 to 11%. But that's what we're going to need to target. Now, the way people are looking at this in terms of improving the efficiency really is correlated to the solar spectrum, right? I mean, that's basically the source of the energy that we're dealing with. And as Dan pointed out, the amount of energy hitting the Earth's surface in one day is roughly equal to global power consumption right now for 30 years. Okay, and we are not taking advantage of that. Nature figured it out billions of years ago. Mankind is a little behind the curve. Granted, we haven't had 4 billion years to work on it, but nevertheless, you know, there's no magic bullet for the power problem, right? Everything, like Dan was pointing out, everything can play a role. Nuclear, biomass, hydro, geothermal, all these things can play a role, but the one that's the most globally accessible energy source is definitely the sun, and it's also the one that we have that is way and above the amount of energy that we need can be accessed from the sun. What you're looking at here is some data that I pulled off of the NOAA website, and what's in red is basically the photon flux. Okay, so that's basically the photons reaching the Earth's surface. This is for the northern hemisphere, sort of averaged over the day. And the photon flux maximum is about 700 nanometers. Right? A lot of the higher energy photons get lost because of scattering through the atmosphere. So the maximum in terms of photons that are actually reaching the Earth's surface is about 700 nanometers. That's fine when we're thinking about photons that we want to capture. Right. But in terms of power, obviously the shorter wavelength photons have more intrinsic energy associated with them, and that's really what's going to afford us the higher efficiency, in my opinion. That shifts to the blue to about 500 nanometers. So this blue line right here is basically a scaling of the energy of the photons. So if you take the photon flux times the energy of the photons, you reproduce the power spectrum of the sun hitting the Earth's surface. So just to keep in mind what you want to think about in terms of short circuit current that is capturing the photons, that's going to scale roughly with the photon flux, but the amount of energy, the open circuit voltage, the power you're going to produce out of your device really has to scale with the power spectrum that's hitting the Earth's surface, the energy per photon. Okay? And improvements in efficiency in these cells is going to rely on sort of optimizing those two variables. And right now in this field, only one of those variables is being pursued. And the stuff we're doing in my group is trying to open up scientific avenues to where we can really start coupling more directly into the power spectrum and boost the efficiency of these devices. So the way people are doing it right now is a perfectly reasonable idea, and they're trying to develop what are called black absorbers. So I mentioned that one of the really interesting features from a chemist's point of view for these types of devices is that the absorption cross-section properties of these solar cells are really tunable. This is dramatically different than, of course, in semiconductor-based devices where the nature of the material basically defines what your absorption cross-section is. These materials can be tailored chemically to match the solar spectrum in principle. So the principle is there anyway to really optimize the absorption cross-section between your solar cell and the solar spectrum, be it the power or the photon flux. This molecule marked N3 is this compound right here. It's a bisphipyridine, bisthiocyanate. It's called N because the Gretzel student, Nazaruddin, is the one who did the initial research. It's number 3 because that's the third chromophore that he worked on. The last paper I saw, there's an N800 and something. So they've been working on this pretty frantically for a while. So basically what they decided to do is let's try and get a better match to the absorption spectrum. And so what you can do is you can modify these compounds chemically. And in this case, they went from the bisphipyridine-bisthiocyanate to a terpyridine tristhiocyanate. And what that does is that essentially shifts your absorption spectrum. It broadens it out. So that now you can start capturing these photons more toward the near-infrared. Okay? And so this molecule, the N3, was missing a lot of the photon flux. Remember I said the photon flux maximizes around 700 nanometers. So what this black dye is doing is essentially trying to increase your short circuit current density by capturing a larger fraction of the solar spectrum. And that's a perfectly valid idea. And they did, in fact, increase the efficiency. This N3 dye operates at about 7 or 8%. And when you go to this black dye, you jump up to 10.5%. Okay? So the idea does work. The problem is that it's not accessing where all the power that's available in the sunlight. That's the big problem with this kind of approach, because of the mechanism by which this electron injection process is occurring. And that's basically this notion of hot versus cold injection. And by hot versus cold, I'm talking about, you know, is the molecule electronically or vibrationally hot versus electronically or vibrationally cold in the excited state. So the operative mechanism that these black absorbers are going off of is basically the following. You're looking at electron injection or reactivity out of the lowest energy excited state of the molecule. This harkens back to decades of bimolecular photochemistry where you excite a molecule, you create a reactive excited state, and then that undergoes diffusion and interacts with something and you get some chemistry, electron transfer or whatever. And the time scale of diffusion, obviously everyone here knows that is going to be much, much slower than anything that's going to serve to deactivate your underlying excited states. So by the time bimolecular redox chemistry occurs, you're in your lowest energy excited state, basically waiting for a reagent to come along. The same idea is being used in these Gretzel cells. So basically, if I hit the molecule with a red photon, I'm going to go, you know, vibrational relaxation, intersystem crossing, what have you, and then I'm going to get electron injection into the TiO2 conduction band from that state. Okay? My open circuit voltage is still defined here between the quasi-Fermi level and this redox couple right here. If I now go ahead and say, okay, I'm going to now try and broaden my absorption cross-section, and I'm going to say I'm now going to excite into a higher lying band using a blue photon, that works just fine. But if I'm going by cold injection, I'm going to undergo that same relaxation down the lowest energy excited state, follow the same K1 pathway for injection, and what I've just done is I've pissed away a lot of energy. Right? All of this energy is going to be dissipated as heat, either vibration relaxation within the chromophore, or if you even get injection up here, it's going to dissipate within the conduction band. Right? And so if you just do the math, if you have, say, an 800 nanometer photon versus a 400 nanometer photon, you're wasting about a factor of 2 of the potential efficiency that you've got in your cell because of this dissipation of heat. And this basically is one of the intrinsic limitations of semiconductor-based devices, right? Because you're talking about having a higher energy photons going in, but those higher energies are not being effectively utilized to produce larger potentials. In terms of chromophore design, what you have to worry about in terms of the injection dynamics is, of course, this excited state needs to be coupled to the TiO2 conduction band. You have to have some mechanism for the electron transfer to actually occur. So the design considerations in terms of what the chemist needs to think about and the state that's important for the spectroscopist is going to be this lowest energy excited state. Right? If, however, we now think about hot injection, the picture changes fundamentally. With hot injection, what we're talking about is trying to access the intrinsic energy stored in the Francona state. That is, I want to hit the system with a photon, and I don't want that molecule to dissipate its energy intramolecularly. I want to use that photon, that excited state energy, directly to do injection. The advantages there are a number of them in terms of design considerations. Here you only have to worry about the absorptive properties. You don't have to characterize in detail the lower energy excited states because they're not going to be part of the problem. Right? They're going to simply be states that will provide the activation pathways, which we're going to have to worry about. But we don't really have to worry in too much detail about the lowest energy excited states. But the important thing, of course, is that whereas here my open circuit voltage is defined by this, if I lock this state in position where the injection is going to occur, when I move to a bluer absorbing species, I can now inject from that same state, and what I've done is I've dramatically increased my open circuit voltage. Right? So now I'm not wasting the energy inherent in a 400 nanometer photon versus 800 nanometer photon like I am in cold injection. This hot injection is taking intrinsic advantage of the energy contained in that blue photon, which means that we're now coupling to the power spectrum of the sun instead of the photon flux, which is going to improve the efficiency dramatically. So if you go through the math, if you just do this between a 400 nanometer and 800 nanometer photon, the efficiency of the cell will more than double just by doing this one thing, everything else being equal. Yep.
I'm sorry, but I'm a little bit confused because it looks to me like the real difference here is essentially the redox potential of the sensitizer.
Well, yeah, so to take advantage of hot injection, you are going to have to modify this as well. You can't do that in the cold injection system because you'll lose the driving force. Actually, the kinetics will just kill you.
You can't find just lowest excited states that would fulfill that diagram there where your S double star would simply be an S star of a different molecule.
But then that lowest excited state, so you have to move this entire thing down in order to increase this open circuit voltage. If you don't move everything down, then you're in the same situation. Yeah, that's the problem. So yes, it's not just a matter of doing this. When you move this around, you're going to have to move this around as well. But once you find things that work in different regions of the spectrum, the solar cell is done. You don't have to do any more tweaking of the system. Right? So there will not be one redox couple that works the entire thing. If you're in that situation, you're not using the energy of the excited state. Yeah. So you've got substantial potential for increasing the efficiency, but there are some problems. Obviously, there are lower energy excited states of the molecules that are going to play a role. And specifically, what's going to happen is that there are going to be intramolecular relaxation processes which are going to serve to deactivate these initial Frank-Hannon states and produce these lower energy excited states. And this is where the ultrafast spectroscopy that we do in my group comes into play. Because if you're going to get this to work, what you need to the ratio that's going to be critical is the ratio of K2, the interfacial electron transfer, versus all these processes are going to serve to take you out of the Frank-Hannon state down to these lower energy excited states. You have to understand what's driving the kinetics of this process, and then try and design molecular systems where you can accentuate the interfacial electron transfer rate or slow down that K3 process in order to get decent electron injection efficiencies. Yeah?
This is just following up on Keith's question.
Yeah.
So can you explain to us why you can't just keep S star up where S double star is and lower?
You can do that, but the energy you're getting out is dictated by the quasi-Fermi level. So you can inject as high as you want, right? But you're not going to gain anything by doing that, right? Because if you have a state here versus a state way up here, right? You can certainly, but you're still in the same situation, right? You're still in the same situation. By doing this, you can basically tune across the entire solar spectrum. And you optimize it for different wavelength regions in order to get the maximum amount of energy out. If you have an excited state up here, you can excite way up there, and you'll get injection, in principle, by hot injection, but you're losing all this energy as heat, so you don't gain anything.
You could just do cold injection, and you get the same benefit.
Yeah. Cold injection with a bigger band gap in the molecule.
Okay, if you want to modify the material, if you want to use a material with a bigger band, you mean a bigger band gap here or a bigger band gap in here? Right, but then what you're doing is you're starting to shift the absorption cross section of the material further and further into the blue. Right. So it's a balance of all these factors that have to be taken into consideration. You can certainly make a much bluer absorption material, but now you're going to start to push toward the 400 nanometer region and toward the near ultraviolet where the solar flux is not that high. So you're going to lose your short circuit current because you're not going to be able to capture as many photons by doing that. Yep.
I guess the question is, why is that important? Because even though you're shifting, you're still wasting any energy that goes into any photons that you absorb into lower excited levels don't matter anyway. You can not as well subtract them from the absorption spectrum, right?
So say that again.
It's not clear why it's a problem with S single star being up where S double star is. Why is that undesirable?
I wasn't saying that. I mean, this could be. This is just for illustrative purposes. You will have lower energy excited states. This may become a little bit clearer when I talk about what the nature of these states are. So, one of the things you also want to do is you want to move away from being in the second row of the periodic table to the first row of the periodic table. And the first row of the periodic table, the only way these things are going to work is by this hot injection mechanism. So, if we can wait a little bit till I get to one or two more slides, this may clear up the questions you guys are having, right? Because there's a cost issue associated with the material you're using. The ruthenium-based chromophores, which basically operate by cold injection, there's about a factor of 100 or 1,000 cost difference versus using iron-based materials. What we want to try and do from a cost perspective is go to the first row of the periodic table, which are much cheaper materials, and the only way those things are going to work is by hot injection because of the nature of low-energy excited state. So what you're saying is exactly right if you want to stay using second and third row metal complexes, yes, in principle. But what we want to try and do is we want to exploit this mechanism to allow us to use cheaper materials like iron-based compounds, and the only way the iron-based compounds are going to work is if this type of a mechanism is what's going on. So is that sort of, does that clear up your question? Yeah, does that clear up your question? Okay. So this is where the ultrafast spectroscopy comes into play because we need to learn a lot more about what's going on here. Now, hot injection is not something that certainly that we came up with. We've been other groups have looked at this as well. This is some work we published a few years ago with Nate Lewis just to see if hot injection, if the interfacial electron transfer can kinetically compete with intramolecular relaxation kinetics. And so what you're looking at here is some ultrafast spectroscopy that we carried out on a variation of the N3 dye adsorbed to TiO2. Now these ruthenium chromophores have singlet as well as triplet charge transfer excited states. The absorption that you see in the ground state is a singlet A1 singlet charge transfer absorption. That's depicted by the solid line here, right here. And then there's a lower line triplet excited state. Now one of the problems that you have when you're doing ultrafast spectroscopy in transition metal complexes is that the absorption spectra are very, very broad and sort of nondescript. So knowing exactly what it is you're looking at tends to be a bit of a challenge. Certainly characterizing the lowest energy excited state is not a problem. You can capture a full spectrum, but knowing what the absorption spectrum is going to be of your initially formed excited state can be very challenging if it doesn't last very long. That's particularly the case in these second and third row metal complexes, where the only difference, in at least at first principle, between these two states is spin multiplicity. And how to predict what those absorption cross-sections are going to look like, this one relative to this one, can be a little bit challenging. What we decided to do instead is just use variable excitation wavelength spectroscopy. If you look at the absorption spectra of these compounds, the dominant band in the visible is the singlet-singlet absorption, but on the red edge of the feature, there's a very weak transition which corresponds to direct excitation into the triplet. So what we said is, well, to see if hot injection is actually occurring, we'll simply excite first at 500 nanometers, which is predominantly hitting the singlet state, and that's the trace you see right here. And when we tune the excitation to 560 nanometers, which is predominantly hitting this one, one of the kinetic components disappears. Now, these injection dynamics in these TiO2-based solar cells are typically multiphasic. You typically see about 100 femtosecond or less injection process, as well as multi-picosecond processes. The fact that this fast component is present when we hit the singlet excited state, but it disappears once you selectively go into the triplet excited state, suggests that this fast process right here is actually coming from this initially formed electronic state. So hot injection does occur. The question is, can we actually, number one, design systems which really take advantage of it, and number two, does that let us design a whole new class of solar cells where the efficiencies have the potential to really increase quite dramatically? And one of the more tantalizing papers that's come out in this context was published in 1998 by Sue Ferrer and Brian Gregg from NREL, where they actually took an iron compound and they prepared a solar cell. And it worked. And for reasons I'm going to talk about in a second, this sort of is our first indication that hot injection might be a mechanism that we can really exploit. The reason being the nature of the electronic structure difference between iron and ruthenium. Okay, so iron and ruthenium, iron 2, ruthenium 2 are isoelectronic, they're both D6. But because of the nature of the ligand field strength, there's a fundamental difference and a very important difference from a mechanistic point of view between the two compounds. So this is a Tanabe-Sugano diagram for a D6 metal ion. These are all ligand field excited states, which are localized on the metal. Charge transfer excited states basically correlate with redox potentials. So an MLCT excited state energy roughly tracks with the oxidation potential of the metal and the reduction potential of the ligand. They don't have any intrinsic ligand field strength per se, so they basically appear as a flat line here. Ruthenium compounds are going to be sitting way out here. When you go from the first to the second row of the periodic table, all things being equal, your ligand field strength jumps by about 30%. Right? So the vast majority of ruthenium compounds, at least the ones that are of interest in these solar cells, have as their lowest energy excited states charge transfer type excited states. Iron compounds are different. Right? Their intrinsic ligand field strength is weaker, such that they're actually sitting with their excited state energies way over here. So their lowest energy excited states are not the charge transfer excited states, which are going to be reactive toward electron transfer into the TiO2, but rather ligand field states, which are localized on the metal center. So if we map where the conduction band roughly is in these types of systems, we see that with ruthenium compounds, our lowest energy excited state is going to be above the conduction band edge. It has the proper characteristics to inject into the TiO2, so cold injection works just fine for those types of materials. In the case of iron, you can form your charge transfer excited states, but your lowest energy excited states are, number one, localizing the metal so they don't have good coupling to TiO2, but more importantly, they lie below the conduction band edge in generally, so it's endothermic to actually get electron transfer into the conduction band. So both those things are working against you in the case of iron. The fact that Ferrer and Gregg actually could produce a solar cell that actually works means that the hot injection process is actually operative in those types of cells. The problem is that those cells are about two orders of magnitude less efficient than the ruthenium analogs. Okay, and we've discovered why that's the case, and I'll show you that in a little bit. So hot injection is going to be the only way you're going to get things to happen in iron, and more importantly, for the first row of transition series in general. Why we think that's significant? Well, you're talking about an enormous reduction in cost when you go from the second row to the first row of the periodic table. If you want to make a good photovoltaic that's going to have market penetration like Dan talked about, you need to make cheap materials. TiO2 is wonderfully cheap. Ruthenium is not that cheap. If you can make a cell that's as or more efficient than the ruthenium-based one based on iron, you're talking about an enormous drop in cost. Okay, so that's one of the major motivating driving forces. Not to mention the fact I'd love to submit a grant that says we're making solar cells out of paint chips and rust. That'd be really cool. It's not quite that easy, but you know, who knows. There are a lot of environmental advantages. It opens up the entire first row of the periodic table, which right now people don't think about using first row metal complexes for photoredox chemistry, which is all we're really talking about right here, because of the diffusion problem and the fact that on the time scale of diffusion, you're in a ligand field excited state, which doesn't do redox chemistry. These things are covalently bound to the surface of the TiO2 particle. We don't have to wait for diffusion. So if we can figure out a way chemically to access that initially formed excited state, then all the problems that the first row series has typically for photo-induced electron transfer totally go away. And you can take advantage of the fact that you're using a covalently linked system to do your chemistry. And it also opens up a whole new series of potential redox couples. One of the banes of this field is the fact that the redox couple that works the most is this I2, I minus combination. Of course, iodide has a pretty strong absorption cross-section, so a lot of the photons that would ordinarily be going into producing photocurrent in the case of the I2, I minus system basically aren't being used because the electrolyte is absorbing some of the photons. So if we can get away from that with iron-based redox chemistry or first-row redox chemistry, that's also going to increase our short-circuit current. So there are a lot of advantages in principle if we can figure out how to make this work. So what we needed to figure out basically was how these types of iron compounds behave on short timescales. So the dynamics we're looking at are going to be picosecond to femtosecond timescale dynamics. Nothing was known about this K3 process, how first-row transition series deactivate their initially formed excited state. So we need to basically do some very fundamental spectroscopy in order to figure out what exactly it is we're up against. I'm going to go through this a little quickly because I'm kind of running out of time. What we did is we used some synthetic chemistry to help us out in this regard. As I mentioned, the problem with doing ultrafast spectroscopy in particular or on transition metal complexes is you get very broad, very featureless spectra. It's very difficult to identify what excited states you're actually looking at. In the case of iron, the particular compound that we prepared, we're able to actually work around that in the following way. So if you remember from that Tsunade-Sugano diagram, what we're dealing with is our low spin compounds. All right? So those are the highly absorptive compounds, very high absorption cross-sections. The lowest energy excited state of those compounds, pretty much across the board, is the high spin form of that molecule. So the low spin has a single day one ground state. The high spin form is the lowest energy excited state. That's a quintet T2. With the iron chemistry and the ligand design that we have, we can actually go into the lab and prepare a molecule that has the absorption spectrum in its ground state that corresponds to the excited state absorption spectrum of our other compound. And basically what we're doing is, if I put a proton at this ortho position, this compound is low spin iron 2. If I change that to a methyl group, the sterics are such that the ground state of that methylated version is the quintet T2 state. So what I can basically do is I can make a molecule, put in a bottle, and get a spectrum of what the excited state of my compound of interest is going to look like. And I can use that as my metric to figure out what all the dynamics are going to be later on down the line. And that turns out to be a fairly useful thing. Here are some nanosecond data. So the blue line is the calculated difference spectrum that you get between this low spin and high spin molecule. And this nanosecond difference spectrum in black is what you get experimentally when you excite the low spin form and you produce the long-lived excited state. This has about a 60 nanosecond lifetime. We've also done some, this isn't really relevant for solar cells, but it was a cool experiment, so I'll show you. So we collaborated with Bob Schoenlein at the ALS to do some picosecond X-ray absorption spectroscopy. One of the hallmarks of going of iron-based photophysics is that there's an enormous structural difference between the low spin form and the high spin excited state. It's about 2/10 of an angstrom. So we thought this was a perfect opportunity to use ultrafast X-ray absorption spectroscopy to look at the structure of the excited state that we're producing upon photoexcitation. So this was done at the Advanced Light Source. time resolution is about 70 picoseconds. Again, we can use the steady state spectroscopy of the low spin and high spin forms to basically tell us what we should be seeing in our time resolved experiment. So this red line right here corresponds to the steady state X-ray absorption spectrum of the low spin compound. The blue dashed line is the steady state X-ray absorption spectrum of the high spin form. So when we excite the low spin form, we should produce the high spin form. And so we can expect to see substantial differences in the X-ray absorption profile. And in fact, that's what you see. What you're looking at up here is the different spectrum following excitation. This is a spectral slice of 330 picoseconds. These right here are the data that you acquire. This is the simulated X-ray difference spectrum that you get by taking the low spin X-ray absorption and the high spin X-ray absorption. From this, you can Fourier transform, and the bond distance change that you see in the excited state exactly matches what we get from X-ray crystallography on the high spin form of the compound. So it really provides absolute definitive structural information of the state that we're looking at. And right here, we can see the kinetics. We only had 70 picosecond resolution. They're currently working on 100 femtosecond resolution experiments, which should actually allow us to essentially create a motion picture, if you will, of the structural change associated with this molecule as it forms the high-spin excited state, which would be not relevant for solar cells, but it's kind of cool. Anyway, so in looking at the kinetics of the excited state, we use transient difference spectroscopy. I should point out these are not chirp-corrected. Some of the data I'll show you later are. The spectrum evolves very, very rapidly. The high-spin excited state is actually completely formed by 700 femtoseconds. So this is an extremely fast process, formerly a delta S equals 2 transition from a single charge transfer excited state to a quintet ligand field state, and it's happening with a rate constant that exceeds 10 to the 12th per second. So these surface crossings in metal complexes are exceedingly fast, largely driven by the large nuclear displacement associated with potential surfaces. We've looked at this in a bit more detail. One of the problems that you have, again, with these spectra is our excited state spectrum is much less absorbing than the ground state. So when you're just looking at different spectra in certain regions of the spectrum, for example, in this mid-visible region, the calculated difference spectrum doesn't look very much different than just the negative of the ground state absorption. Right? So obviously when you do excitation, you're going to get ground state absorptive loss at the instant the photon absorbs. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're characterizing the excited state properly if your two different spectra look essentially the same. But if you go out here, you can see that the high spin state actually has a very large absorption cross section, and more importantly, as Dan suggested from the work that Niels did, you look for isospestics. So what we did basically is we installed a second OPA to let us tune out more toward the ultraviolet, and we did single wavelength probe measurements following charge transfer excitation, and you can see here at 300 nanometers, you see a net absorptive. This is vibrational cooling right here. At 320 nanometers, you see a net bleach. So we can determine that the isospestic between the ground state and the excited state that's being formed is somewhere, it's 310 plus or minus 5 nanometers. That's exactly where the isospestic is for the high spin, low spin form. So we can determine from this that the time constant for forming this quintet excited state is on the order of about 200 femtoseconds. So it's an extremely rapid process. Okay. But that's really, that tells us what the lowest energy excited state is. So if you go back to that diagram, this is an S double star, this is S star. We now need to figure out how does S double star get down to S star, because that's the process that we're going to fight against if we're going to get injection to work in an efficient manner. And so the way we do that is to use spectroelectrochemistry. This is another way we can give ourselves an indication as to what the absorptive properties of the state that we're looking for actually are. And as I mentioned, the charge transfer excited states energetically can be characterized by looking at the redox potential of the chromophore, that is the oxidation potential of the metal, reduction potential of the ligand. If you take a spectra of those two species, you can actually get a spectroscopic signature of what the excited state should look like. And so basically that's depicted here. I oxidize my chromophore, that's going to give me the oxidative part of the excited state, and this spectrum right here is going to give me the reductive part of that spectrum. Tom Meyer, over many years, basically showed that the charge transfer excited state of ruthenium chromophores basically looks like a superposition of these two spectra. Turns out it works just as well for iron-based compounds. Here's the ground state absorption right here. When I oxidize this, I lose my charge transfer feature. I see a weak ligand and metal charge transfer feature over here. If I take this and reduce it, I see radical anion character associated with the pyridine radical anion that the reduction produces. The feature that's kind of interesting, however, is both the oxidative and reductive part of the spectrum shows a net absorption way out here in the red. Okay? If you think back to the different spectrum I showed you before, the ligand field excited state shows a net bleach. So this gives us our spectroscopic signature to tell us when the charge transfer state, which is the reactive one for the TiO2 based materials, goes away and forms the ligand field state, which is going to be dead. So if we look out here toward the red, you see there's a positive absorption that goes away fairly quickly. We can zero in on that with single wavelength kinetics, and you see concomitant with excitation, there's a very strong absorption at 620 nanometers, which decays with an 80 femtosecond time constant to a negative feature. This is our charge transfer state, which goes away to the ligand field excited state. So when we're here, we can do photovoltaic chemistry. When we're here, the system is dead. So this is largely why, at least for this prototype system, the thing we're going to be fighting against. That's why these iron cells are not working very efficiently, because the charge transfer state simply doesn't last long enough to do any chemistry. We've now looked at this for a whole series of different chromophores. You see the exact same thing for iron trispipy, absorptive charge transfer, bleached to ligand field state. Here's the iron terpyridine. You can zoom in on the iron terpyridine because that's one of the templates that we're using for solar cells. Very short times, these spectra are chirp corrected. Very, very short times, you see a strong absorption in the iron terpyridine. This corresponds exactly to the spectroelectrochemistry indicating that's the charge transfer chromophore. But you can see in a matter of a couple hundred femtoseconds, that species is completely gone. Right? So that's the kinetic problem that we have to face. And then the rest of it simply evolves into a different spectrum of the ligand field versus ground state absorption. The lifetime of this compound in fluid solution is about 3 nanoseconds. So the problem that we're facing then is going to be this deactivation of this charge transfer state. Right? And we looked at Ferrer's compound as well. Not surprisingly, we see the exact same thing. This is the exact molecule that Sue Ferrer and Brian Gregg used to make their solar cell. So the reason that they aren't getting very high efficiencies is because these charge transfer states simply don't last long enough. Right? So now the problem that we face is basically how do we take advantage of this? So ultra-fast deactivation of the charge transfer state is basically the Achilles heel, probably in most first-row transition metal complexes, although we've only exhaustively studied iron too. So that basically means if we're going to try and make these things viable for solar cells, we've got two options. We can either make the injection rate faster, or we can slow down the rate at which these charge transfer states deactivate. The injection rate is already exceeding 10 to the 13th per second, so that's a potential problem. So the approach that we're taking through molecular design is trying to create molecules which would cause these charge transfer states just to last a little bit longer. And we don't need that much. If we have a K2 to K3 ratio of 10 to 1, that's a 90% injection efficiency. Right? 100 to 1 gives us 99%. So we don't really need to increase the lifetime that dramatically. We're talking about lifetimes in the order of a few picoseconds. We actually think will be enough to do the job to get reasonably high injection efficiencies. Then we can start monkeying around with the other part of the cell, find an appropriate redox couple, and we have the potential to really increase this open circuit voltage but maintain the short circuit current density. So I've already run out of time, so I better finish up. So hot injection is a mechanism potentially to increase the efficiency of these solar cells quite dramatically. It's already clear that hot injection does occur, but it doesn't work as effectively. It's not as useful in second and third row metal complexes for reasons that some people in the audience have pointed out. But if you want to move to cheaper materials, if you want to move to the first row of the periodic table, this is the only mechanism that's going to work, at least in sort of a global sense. And so what we're doing in my group right now is combining spectroscopy with synthetic design at the bench to design new types of chromophores. One of the nice features of the terpyridine systems is that they're easily modifiable with carboxylate groups, which means once you find a chromophore which has a long lifetime, you can slap it right onto a Ti2 nanoparticle and make a solar cell and see if you're going in the right direction. And that's some of the work that we're doing in terms of materials development right now. So lastly, in addition to thanking you guys for having me out, I want to point out that the vast majority of this work is being done by a superb student of mine, Amanda Smay. She's going to be graduating in a couple of months, and she's off to a postdoc with Leif Hammerstrom in Uppsala. I have a new student, Allison Brown, who's been taking up the reins in the iron-based chemistry. Nate Lewis, I mentioned, where we've been collaborating for some time in these solar cells, mainly on the ruthenium and osmium-based systems. The ultra-fast X-ray stuff was really, all we did was send molecules and help with the interpretation of some data. Manil Khalil is a postdoc with Bob Schoenlein at the ALS, and she did the extremely hard work associated with that experiment. People help us pay the bills, the Department of Energy, and last but not least, thanks for listening.
Yes, Bob.
I have two questions, but I want to ask them separately.
Okay.
First, you have this relaxation from one electronic state to another.
Right.
And often there might be relatively long-lived excited state. You relax into a long-lived state. Why not absorb a second photon for it?
We haven't considered that, actually. That's an interesting idea.
I mean, that would also provide... the second excited state you could absorb redder photons from.
Yeah.
And then do hot injection from the...
No, that's an interesting idea. I'd have to sit down, and so the lifetimes of these excited states... You also have the kinetics of reproduction to worry about, but a lot of times these excited states are on the order of, let's say, 10 nanoseconds or so, and I'd have to sit down and see if the photon flux would be high enough in a typical application. If you had a concentrator, if you coupled this in with like a solar concentrator, then the type of thing you're thinking about could very well help a lot. So that's an interesting idea I hadn't thought about.
Okay, now you said something about solar concentrators.
Right.
Why do you have to do any chemistry at all? Why not just collect the light and convert it to heat and run a boiler?
There are proposals out there. People are trying to do that. The amount of energy that you need to just basically split water, just I can't remember what the numbers are, but it's enormous. But there are people who are trying to make solar collectors like that.
But you run a boiler, you generate electricity by the ordinary conventional.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because what the ones that I've seen are people trying to make concentrators to actually break to basically split water just with solar energy directly. To be honest, I don't know the thermodynamics associated with that, so I'm not sure how feasible that is. I don't know if Dan knows.
Yeah, the other problem is, there's still efficiency issues, but I'm sure engineers can overcome them. But what you're missing is the storage part. So if you're going to run any large energy economy, at the end of the day, you want to have a fuel or you want to be able to transport. So
what you're talking about would be basically energy production on the fly, right?
Yeah. Don't you do that with nuclear as well? You generate it, but you don't store it?
Right, but that you can do during the night, too.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just, you're right, Bob.
But it's not night everywhere on Earth.
Right.
No, in principle, and I think actually what you're pointing out quite rightly is that
Jim said that.
There's apparently that picture proves it. So, I'm of the opinion that almost every idea needs to be pursued, because I don't think one thing is going to solve the problem. Right, so I think all these are perfectly reasonable things to pursue. Which one ends up being the most efficient or wins out in the end from cost production point of view, hard to say. But I think all these ideas merit attention, because no one thing is going to solve it. It's going to have to be a combination of factors, a combination of approaches that are all going to have to be used.
Other question?
Yeah.
There are a lot of different factors that limit the overall efficiency of a process at all.
Yeah. Yeah, that ends up being quite an active debate usually at these talks. Right now, with the ruthenium-based ones, so the ones that have the highest efficiency right now, the stuff I'm talking about absolutely irrelevant, because the injection yield is 100%. Right, the lowest energy excited state is above the conduction band edge. Where things are being lost largely is in the open. There are two places. Collection efficiency is a problem. The incident current, photon to current efficiency is sitting at around 70-ish%, and it changes with wavelength. That's a problem. You're losing some there. But it's really in the open circuit potential, which is largely what this hot injection is designed to get around. Because you have to have so much driving force from the redox couple into the oxidized sensitizer to prevent back electron transfer out of the TiO2 that you're killing yourself on the upper end, that you're restricting your gap between your quasi-Fermi level and the redox pair so much, because you need so much driving force in order for you to re-reduce that hole before you short-circuit the entire thing. So that's where I think, if you had to pick one thing, that's the biggest problem. And it hasn't been without people trying to pursue that. I mean, Gretzel has 30, 40 people, and I know a lot of them, all they do is just try different redox couples. Everyone would love to get away from this I-, I-3- crap that people use. But the fact is, after 15 years of working on this, that still works the best for reasons that are not obvious. So it's a great question. The answer is less obvious. Yeah?
How sensitive are these dye-based solar cells under real conditions to oxidation or degradation by sunlight?
So degradation by sunlight is so the cells that are working right now are hermetically sealed. So it's a liquid-based electrolyte, which isn't ideal. People are trying to do work now to develop solid electrolytes, whole transport to replace the liquid. So in the hermetically sealed cells, the lifetimes are actually pretty robust. Like I said at the beginning of the talk, sort of simulated lifetimes of, 10, 15 years, and these things still go pretty strong. So they seem to be fairly robust, but there are some practical problems with using a liquid electrolyte. I don't know that enough is known yet about the long-term stability of the solid-based electrolyte, because they're still working out some of the bugs in that. So, but if you get a hermetically sealed cell, these things are pretty robust. They're actually pretty robust. I think the DOE target, I think, is I think it's 15 years or 20 years per module, and these things are you know, within spitting distance of that. So from that point of view, they're actually not too bad. But with the liquid electrolyte, you're going to have, you know, long term, there's going to be leakage issues. If you have, you know, it's not just a matter of saying, oh, I've simulated 10 years worth of sunlight in 3 days. What about 10 or 15 years of organic solvent just sitting there? And, you know, and I think those things are still up for debate. So if you go to a solid-based electrolyte, I think the potential is there for these things to last quite a long time.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jim. Great. Thanks. Talk.